Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with agricultural journalist Peter Burke.
Hi folks, and welcome back to another edition of Farming Aotearoa, sponsored by Rural News, the newspaper that gets the top stories to farmers every week. And this month, there's a lot of top stories, and to tell us all about these in the studio with me is agricultural journalist Peter Burke, who works for Rural News. Hello.
Surprise, surprise, yes. Okay. Right, so quite a lot going at the moment.
Well, there's a lot. Can I just stop you before you go any further? Because I've got someone wearing the most glarish, bright outfit. It's an interesting outfit you've got on today.
It is. It's a celebration of the Irish being bright and gay. Don't take the other word literally, but it's Melbourne Cup Day, so I thought I'd wear my green Irish trousers,
yep,
an Irish jersey, but also just put a flavour of pink over the top of it all, which comes from Rarotonga. It's actually the polo shirt of the brewery of Rarotonga.
There
of all
you go.
Places. So there we go. So I'm going to try and shock my golfing mates today. We'll probably play badly as a result of looking at me all the time and getting their shots wrong.
Well,
that's the hope of winning it.
You've shocked me anyway, so that's I'm certainly awake now. And of
that's
course,
good.
We're pre-recording
this. It is very shocking in the morning, isn't it?
Yeah. Melbourne Cup would have been gone by the time this goes to air, but anyway.
Yeah, and I probably will win neither, but anyway.
Well, that's okay, as long as the horses are okay. Okay,
yeah.
Now tell us about what's been going on. A lot has actually been going on in the last four
weeks. It
has
been, and it's interesting stuff too. Well, the big issue probably for farmers has been the sale of Fonterra's brands to Lactalis, the French company. The brands represent a small portion of Fonterra's actual portfolio. It's about 7 or 8%. But they are very traditional brands. The Anchor brand goes back to the 1886 of all time, so it's a very, very old brand. It's been around for a long time. And we've got Winston Peters out there really having a go at Fonterra. He's called them, he describes the thing as utter madness. He said it is not the right decision in the long term. It will come back and bite farmers in the long term. It is a sugar hit is another way of describing it. He's come with quite a lot of phrases, which are interesting because one can understand why Fonterra wants to get rid of those brands because they say they're costly to maintain. Talking to some people, they will tell me that the biggest issue for Fonterra is trying to deal with the complaints around brands from time to time. However, it is a very iconic thing for New Zealand. It is, are you selling the Kiwi flag? I don't know. It's quite big. Winston would argue that not only farmers are involved, farmers decided overwhelmingly to vote to sell them, 87%, which is a very high number. And at the sugar hit at the end of that, it'd be an average of about at least $200,000 or $300,000 each for that sale. And that's fine, but you'll never do it again. The question that's being raised is, if you sell the brands, Is there a guarantee that the French company will come and buy your milk after that? Now, it's not a lot of milk, but will they not? There's no guarantee they will. It's likely is the word we get from Fonterra, not definitely. And that's what Winston is on about. And I think it's interesting to see just where it's going. It's dead now because the sale is done and the farmers will get their money next year. But there's interesting that if you look at it in history, and I'm not sure that everyone in the mainstream media looks at history very much. It's something that's a bit of an anathema to most of them. But when the farmers voted down the wool board in the about 20 or 30 years ago, the wool industry collapsed basically because there was no promotion of it. And we're now on the back foot with wool all the time, wondering where it's going. Are the brands as valuable as that? I don't know. I'm not offering an opinion on this. But just saying it is not all Fonterra will say it's the right decision, and they may be right. Winston and others are saying it's not, and I've got two opinions of friends who have been in the industry. One says it's the right thing, the other says it's a completely wrong thing.
Gee, okay.
So it's a debate that I think will continue because it's fine for it'll bring some instant money into some of the rural areas. Probably what most of it will be done, farmers will probably pay back debt. And the dairy industry is, of course, has the highest level of debt than all the farming sectors put together. It's very high. So that will be part of it. But there won't be another fix for it. And if things go belly up in the future, there's no way. And there's a bit of a thing which probably farmers won't like me saying, but there is a tendency among farmers to socialise their losses and capitalise their gains. Now, whether this is going to be the case in the future, who knows? But that's been said before. There's a truism in it. Just how we go, who knows? But the Fonterra sale is controversial. People would say, one of my colleagues would say, it's all about farmers. Yes, it is, but it's about this generation, the next generation, and the generation after that. It's also about New Zealand Inc. because the dairy industry is the biggest single earner of overseas money for the primary sector. It's $27 billion, I think. Next one down is about 12. So it's big. If that goes belly up, we do too. So there's that. That's the thing, which is interesting.
Okay. Well, talk to me then about biosecurity and the new MPI lab that's being built.
Yeah, biosecurity is probably one of the biggest single things for New Zealand. I remember talking to one Minister of Agriculture. I forget who it was. It might have been Damien O'Connor, who said the only three things that keep him awake at night are biosecurity, biosecurity, and biosecurity. And what that means is that New Zealand is very vulnerable because it is a primary exporter. Therefore, anything that gets in, be it any sort of pest, disease that affects the food industry, foot and mouth would be critical for New Zealand. We've been through one episode of that. Well, there wasn't one, but I remember back in my last days in television, back in 81, I think it was, there was a suspected outbreak down in Temuka, and it was on a pig farm. They slaughtered all the pigs on that farm, even though they didn't know that they were certain of it. The other one that occurred was one that, again, I've covered, was on Manu Island where they had some sheep, and they believed there was a chance they had the disease called scrapie. They slaughtered 5,000 sheep on that island, dug a grave, a big hole at the top of the... So we have a policy generally of being very, very tight with biosecurity. So what the MPI are doing is building a new laboratory in Auckland. They have one at the moment at Tamaki, which is an older laboratory. It's out of date, basically. And there's been some people saying, why are you spending all this money? Well, the answer is, I can't see why people should be criticising that, quite frankly. To me, that's pretty dumb thing to do. But there's some that do it, and opposition paper cover that story that way. We have a slightly different view of it. The other thing about it is that this facility is going to be built on the same campus as Plant and Food Research in Auckland at Mount Albert. And that's a plus because we are seeing a number of what I call science campuses. Massey is a good example of that, where you've got the Fonterra R&D Development Centre opposite Massey. You've got a number of other science institutes based there as well. So you've got these, I guess collaboration centres, if you like. And obviously Auckland is a very good example of that because of a number of things. Firstly, a lot of our plant material comes through Auckland. The number of passengers coming off aircraft, greatest number comes through Auckland, so you've got an issue there. It's also very handy to the other main ports of entry, which are Tauranga, because Tauranga is a very big port, a lot of access going in and out of there, handy to Northland as well. So it is a hub, and it is a very good idea. So I think the idea of MPI doing this is a really good decision. It is, I guess, giving us some resilience around it. We already have laboratory for livestock at Wallaceville near Upper Hutt, and that's a quarantine facility as well. So if there's a foot and mouth disease, that's where the first port of call is. But there is no other facility like it. This one will mirror that completely. So if per chance there is an F&D outbreak, it can take capacity in Auckland as well. If there's an earthquake in Wellington, the building gets damaged, there will be another facility in Auckland that's capable of dealing with those things. So I cannot understand how people are so stupid as to criticise this idea.
Just minimising your risk.
It's risk management. Yeah. And the risk to New Zealand is huge. If you think of, you know, that 80% of our income comes from the primary sector, why on earth would we be compromising on that? It just doesn't make sense at all. So the aim is to get a facility which will last us for another 50 or so years. The present facility at Tamaki is okay. It's getting there. This will take a couple of years to get built, but the foundations are down for it now. And we'll contain new technologies to deal with some of the issues that may arise. And I guess the thing is that you've got to be not only up to the game, but you've got to be ahead of the game. So the aim will be that with biosecurity, not only dealing with the things we know about, but possibly being prepared for the things that we don't know about. And like we've had fruit fly in Auckland, those sort of issues, we've had other things, we've had hornets up Auckland. They've probably come through containers that have come through. And therefore, that port is particularly, and Tauranga the same, but Tauranga tends to be more of an export port than an import port. But a lot of stuff goes to Auckland by air, by sea. Having a really good facility, good science people, and then being able to have the advantage of working alongside other scientists who are dealing with the same sort of thing. Like we know, for example, during COVID, a lot of scientists from MPI and others helped in that facility because they were entomologists. They were able to do things which helped to get that thing through. So it's a science hub, if you like. It's a good thing, and good on MPI for having the guts to go ahead and do it, despite some rather inane critics.
Okay. Tell us about red tape that's in the news again.
Well, it seems like we get the government, the Ministry for Regulation was going to free up everything, and that sounds lovely. And there has been some relaxation of regulations, there's no doubt about that. There is a lot more in the melting pot. But the area that's a particular concern that we're raising at the moment is the one around agrochemicals. And what's happening is that the complaint from the organisation that represents those people, the Animal Health, Animal and Plant Health New Zealand, they used to be called AgCalm for those that go back to those days, they're responsible for representing the manufacturers and importers of chemical products that are used on farm, on orchard, and that sort of thing. Their complaint is that the Department of Regulation reviewed things earlier in the year and said things were not right, they needed to change, and Cabinet agreed with that. But what they're saying is nothing has happened since, and there was a problem. For example, there was one particular chemical that they say the manufacturer lodged an application for in 2019. It's still sitting in the queue. Now, that's, I wonder what people are doing. There's some quite concerning around why this hasn't gone through the system. There are others as well. And so it seems at last that these people are taking some change. They want the ministers to get involved. They want things to move on. And who knows what will happen. But it's another issue of where regulation is stifling, is putting New Zealand on the back foot. Other countries have got these things, like things for wine. There's things in America which the American wine growers are using, Australia the same. And there are things like grass grub. We're running out of solutions for dealing with grass grub. There's a product that's available to deal with that. It's not there at the moment. We can't get it through. Where's it going to end? And I suppose this is an issue which is really a problem for the sector, and one hopes that the government will do something about it.
What about uncertainty over long-term environmental issues?
Well, this comes about because we're coming up to election year now, as you know, and one National have obviously made a clear policy of changing the RMA and saying that you've got to hold back on doing certain things, saying to regional councils, you mustn't do this because we're going to change things, and giving an edict to regional councils to halt certain parts of their planning procedures because there's going to be change coming. On the other hand, we're seeing other parties saying that maybe we will not go ahead with that. So what that does is creating uncertainty, and there is a concern that with a three-year parliament in particular, it doesn't give anyone any time to do anything. You get a year of learning what to do, a year of doing what you want to do, and a year of trying to win the election. And effectively in that third year, things just don't get done. For example, we've seen the legislation around the export of live animals being canned in the meantime because it's considered too political probably to go ahead to an extent. It's been put on the back burner. Otherwise, if there'd been 4 years, I suspect it would have gone through. And this is the same for the RMA stuff, that farmers and the person I talked to, Doug Leader, who's been on the Bay of Plenty Regional Council for many years, knows the farming sector extremely well, says this is the biggest fear that farmers have is around this whole issue of uncertainty. We've been told, yes, it will happen, but we've been told maybe not under our watch. And you can understand how they feel.
Yeah.
And I think the issue has also been talked about is, you know, we've had regional councils now since 1989. They were the last real reform of local government was then. That's when I actually first joined local government, 89. And regional councils were seen as being, they took over catchment boards and planning authorities. They took over other things as well. Wellington, in the case, took transport, water and other things. There's a question mark about what are regional councils valid? Are they doing the job that should be? And that's fine, but still there has to, these jobs have to be done by someone. And when you come, when you boil it down, regional councils are not a bad way of doing it, but maybe the way they do it has to be changed. What we are seeing and have seen over the years is different regional councils adopting different procedures or different rules. For example, you might have a farm in, say, Horizons Regional Council. You might have a farm that's in Environment Waikato. The rules could be different across the border, literally. So if you're trying to farm in two places under two different regimes, it's very difficult. And there is a lack of consistency, it would seem, across the rulemaking in regional councils, which is a pity. For example, I know when I was at Greater Wellington in the early days, the hope was that there would be an interchange of data between all the councils. That hasn't happened. I don't think they can interface with each other. And that seems to me to be ridiculous. And I suspect that in time the government will do some reform around that, probably not the next year, but when if National get into power again, I suspect they will look at it in conjunction with the resource management issue and see where they go. They may well impose what they call more national standards, which means that there will be a greater direction from central government on what they can do and can't do. There will be some flexibility locally, but the aim will be to try to get national consistency, but with flexibility to deal with local issues. So that's what that's about. Interesting comments.
What about, there's a, you're talking about a solution to pollution from Massey Uni.
Yeah, it's Massey University and the local Manawatu Catchment Collective have been doing a lot of work around how do you deal with different things on farms. Nitrate's one of them, and it's obviously an issue. Massey have been doing some work for a long time on wood chip bioreactors, which essentially are placing a pile of wood chips in the ground and putting water through it. And that water and that those wood chips effectively take out the nitrate, most of the nitrate in that water going through it. So I was fortunate enough to go to see an example of that quite recently up in the Manawatu, a catchment called Haynes Creek, where the local farmer, she's a scientist herself, they agreed to put in one of these bioreactors. And certainly what you're seeing is clearer water coming out of that. They had a problem there. Their soils are very difficult to drain, so they drain them into a sort of a into an area which creates a stream, then a pond, and then that pond water goes through this bioreactor. It takes about 18 hours for it to go through, so it's quite a long time. But out the end of it comes much cleaner water, which in turn then goes into the creek that services that area. So it's an attempt by Massey and farmers and catchment authorities to try and get ways of solving problems. This one is more a trial than a reality. They're quite expensive to put in. The bioreactor was about $10,000. It only services about 22 hectares, which is not a lot. However, it might be in certain areas it's an idea. It's been used, I know I've seen it, on another example of that, on the sand country around Bulls and that sort of area around there. So this is work that's being done, and I think what we're saying in this is that people are often very critical of farmers not doing anything about pollution and not doing anything to keep the streams clean. Well, their kids swim in the streams probably more than the city kids do, actually. So why would they want to pollute them? And the cost of doing this is not cheap. And if you're not making a lot of money, then you're not getting a lot of help to do it. You've just got to do your best. But this is an example of farmers absolutely doing the mahi and really getting towards, solution-based basis, and showing examples to other farmers and saying what we can do. It's pretty good.
Learning by distance is in the news. What's that about?
Well, Massey University has traditionally been a university of distance learning. It's always been that way. Extramural, Massey people did degrees and all sorts of things, quite common. But what they're seeing now is a trend around the agricultural subjects, particularly around agriculture, that a huge percentage of students are now doing it by distance. And that's according to Paul Kenyon, who's the head of the School of Agriculture and the Environment, saying that, well, the cost of doing a course is costly, the cost associated with it, the lack of earnings in doing it. But if you do it, if you're on the job and you're doing the course, then you can get the best of both worlds. It will take you longer to do the degree, but it's becoming a more popular phenomenon in the system. And it was interesting that one of the prize winners in the graduate agricultural graduates this year was a young woman from Canterbury, works on a dairy family dairy farm, spends most of her day on the dairy farm, does study at night, in the mornings, a bit at lunchtime. And she's progressing her way through a degree. It'll probably take her 6 years to get it done, as opposed to three that would take if you went there full time. But what she's saying is that by doing the degree by distance, I can relate the theory to the practical of what I'm doing. And I'm not saying that that you get a better degree by doing it, or a worse, or another degree. It's simply another way of doing it. But she says, I find it good that I can get out in the open spaces. I can see what they're telling me. I can look at it on the farm and say, yeah, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea, that works for me. So she's learning, it's progressing her learning on the farm as well.
Yeah, that's great.
So I think it's a really good thing. And it's something that's, we are seeing a spike, should I say, in the number of young people coming into agriculture. School numbers in secondary schools is rising quite dramatically, as we've seen. 200 schools now teaching agri and hort. Others teaching agribusiness, kerfuffle over that recently, but certainly distance education in this sense is now becoming a reality for many agri people.
Massey's got a new vice chancellor.
That's right. Interestingly enough, he's the current head of the Fonterra's R&D centre in Palmerston North. So he's literally got across the road. He's got about 20 steps to get across to his new job. Pierre Venter is a South African. Been in New Zealand since 2011, worked for Fonterra in various roles in that R&D area, all that Palmerston North. And prior to that, he's an academic with a science background, worked in that area in South Africa. So an interesting appointment. He replaces Jan Thomas, who came from Western Australia to from Queensland, I think, originally, to the Massey role. But now Pierre Venter, the thing that's interesting here is that he is a person who's got an academic background, but also a very good commercial background as well. So you're seeing someone coming into the university with a very strong science background and a very good commercial background working for Fonterra. And I think Massey is saying that's a very good thing for them as they move forward into the next, period of time for them. So, a great thing for that.
Excellent. MPI's contribution to trade.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that briefly, but I also want to talk about Jim Bolte before we go too.
Okay.
Because I want to perhaps talk Jim first, then we'll perhaps get on with that if we can. But just to recognise that we lost one of our own up here in the Kapiti Coast, Jim Bolger, a great individual, one of the greatest prime ministers in New Zealand's history. I knew Jim personally from way back in the 70s, and I can only say that he was a role model for prime ministers of his day, before and after. There's only one other one that comes near him, and that's Peter Fraser, in my view, back in the 40s and 50s. But we're sad that we lost him here, but he's had an incredible contribution to New Zealand as a farmer, as a politician, as a minister, and later on in life, and all the things he did. So just a quick, shout out to Jim, a great guy, a very unpretentious, lovely individual, a great family, and one of the most lovely people you could ever wish to meet.
Lovely, yeah. Never retired, always there for people. That's lovely words. Thank you, Peter.
So just another thing about the MPI and trade. This was a little bit about the forgotten role of MPI in terms of what it does. And people seem to think it's a regulatory body. But MPI actually plays quite a big part in the trade negotiations. When we have a free trade agreement, MPI people are there, particularly around the technical aspects of the trade and also around what happens post FTA or whatever. And they do a lot of the negotiation with officials around the technical aspects of getting a trade agreement across the line, of dealing with any problems that occur. And this was just a look at saying, don't forget that MPI is more than just regulatory out in the field. It has a bigger part to play, has a significant part to play in these things. And it was really just an attempt to show what they do, because that role is very important. The technical side of it, the devil is in the detail, really, if you look at it in FTAs. And it comes down to that detail that MPI have a huge input into. And they have offices all over the world. They have a couple in China. They have them in all parts of the world where our major trading partners are. And they are constantly monitoring the situation, getting feedback for intel back to New Zealand. Getting intel from local people is about what trends might be happening. So what do we have to look for? So it's a really important role technically for the farmers, the orchardists, and all those who are exporting to overseas to have an MPI which is on the ground in key places. So that's that.
Wonderful. What about, let's finish it off then maybe with Hawke's Bay.
Yeah, just a quick note about, we've had a lot of storms lately and they've been very bad. But one interesting thing is that parts of Hawke's Bay are getting quite dry now. Mm. And talking to farmers up there, it's only just the beginning of November. It's very early for it to be dry. It's not in all areas, but some of the hill country areas, the sheep and beef farms are finding that streams have dried up. Some dams are not anywhere near full.
Gee, that's early.
It is early. And and they're being pretty cautious about their stock management. They've been getting their lambs off early in many cases, not buying, not trading stock, not bringing extra stock on, just wondering what's going to happen. Now, if this happens in that sort of northwestern area of Hawke's Bay, will it spread up to Tairāwhiti, the east coast? Who knows? But it's also interesting that for the Hawke people, it's actually quite good. They're quite happy with it because it's warm. And so the Hawke people are saying, well, great, we've bread burst is coming along now, we're in good space. But the sheep and beefies are not. It's not a crisis yet by any stretch of the imagination. There's a time where I've called it Baywatch. It's watching what's going on there. And I guess we'll have more coming up in the next program before Christmas.
Yeah, okay. Well, last one for the year next time. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. That was quite a packed program.
Yeah, a lot going.
Yeah, and we'll see you next time.
Deal.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.